Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program takes us to Camden for an address before the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. The speaker is retired U.S. Ambassador Teresita Schaefer, who had a 30-year career in the U.S. Foreign Service. She devoted most of her career to international economic issues and to South Asia. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Here's Teresita Schaefer and her speech, The U.S. and India, Partners in a Globalizing World, on Speaking in Maine.
Thanks to all of you for being here. This was kind of a surprise invitation to me. I got an email one day out of a clear blue sky from a college classmate who'd been a very good friend of mine more years ago than either of us likes to think, asking if I could come up and spend the weekend with them and spend Monday lunchtime with you all. And that was V. Sheehan, who is right here. And here I am. And it's a great pleasure to be back in Maine. Talking about a subject near and dear to my heart. I managed to produce 264 pages on this subject, but I promise not to give you 264 pages worth now. But a couple of weeks ago, I attended a speech by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Washington. And she used an arresting phrase, which I think is actually a fairly useful way to think about how India and the U.S. have worked together or not worked together over the years. She said that it was her goal to bring into full fruition India 3.0. Well, I visited India for the first time as a young diplomat. Actually, I was posted in Pakistan at the time, in 1974. And I was first assigned to New Delhi in 1977. And that was definitely India 1.0. The Cold War was still the organizing principle of U.S. foreign policy and, to a degree, of India's foreign policy. The Soviet Union was India's most important foreign friend, and non-alignment was the underlying principle in the way India looked at the world. And this was the land of stuff that doesn't work. By the time I was in charge of South Asia policy in the State Department, 12 years later, I would say we were on the verge of India 2.0. The Soviet Union was gone. Russia was not able to do for India what it used to. And in my view, more importantly, India's economy had been transformed. It was really starting to move. It was during this period that the United States became India's most important external relationship. What I'd like to talk about today is where we are in the next transformation of U.S.-India ties, what Secretary Clinton would have called the change from 2.0 to 3.0. How has India changed? How have India's ties with the United States changed? And how has the world changed? In other words, why does this matter? And I will wrap up with some thoughts on where I think we are going. But let's start with India. This giant country, India and Brazil are two countries of which wags have often said it's the country of the future and always will be. But I think it's getting closer. There have been four transformations in India in the past two decades. The first is political. A country which for over 30 years had one dominant political party and a bunch of pipsqueaks, real elections, but very much one party that always won. The one dominant party doesn't dominate anymore. That was the Congress. You now have a great fragmentation of politics. You have two parties with national ambitions which have alternated in office, not every time, but they've both held office. And you have a bunch of parties that are based on a single state, and a handful of ideological parties whose fortunes go up and down. So coalition politics is the way you put together governments. This doesn't necessarily mean instability, but it does mean that there's a lot of political domestic calculation behind every major decision that a government makes. The second transformation is the one I alluded to a minute ago, economic. In the 1950s and 60s, India was a sluggish performer, often on the verge of financial and/or crop disasters. By the 1990s, what a change. Not only could they reliably feed themselves and put grain aside, India's economy was reliably growing over twice as fast as its population, and between 2006 and 2008, it topped 9% a year in each of those years. Services represented over half of the economy. Information technology, which had been nowhere in the late 1990s, is now about 5% of the economy, and roughly one-third of export earnings. India doesn't have the kind of export-led growth that China does, but the share of trade in the economy has more than doubled since 1990, 14% in 1990, 34% in 2006, and it's more than that if you include the information technology trade. And the human side of the economy has also been transformed. Literacy is growing smartly. In much of the economy, in much of the country, I would say male illiteracy will be a thing of the past within the next 10 years. And in a handful of states, you'll be able to say the same about women. That's moving more slowly. They still have their problems, geographically very uneven growth, a need for more job creation, and now the impact of the economic crisis. But this economic growth has been sufficient not just to transform what you see when you get off the plane, or at least when you get out of the crummy airport in New Delhi, but also to produce, or to help produce, the third of the transformations I'm talking about, which is in their foreign policy. With economic growth has come a greater sense that economic power is one of the fundamental attributes of national power that they need to cultivate. Hence, much greater attention to the United States, which is a vitally important economic relationship. Hence, greater focus on Asia, on the rest of Asia. China is, depending on how you do the numbers, either their largest or their second largest trading partner. They have very lively economic relations in Southeast Asia and now in Japan. And then, of course, besides the economic dimension, and actually under the economic dimension, I should have mentioned energy. India imports 70% of its energy. With an economy growing at the rates it has, that 70% is going to turn into 90% in relatively short order, which also means that maritime security is critical because that's how the imported energy reaches them. You add to that the end of the Cold War, and the fact that politically India's efforts to make itself a bigger player internationally really can't run through Moscow anymore, and they don't try, so that there's a much different view of which countries matter in the world. The fourth transformation is in their security outlook. India is still concerned about living in a dangerous neighborhood, and of course, when people say India in this country, the first thing you think of is Pakistan. And that is still a problem, and while they've done a lot of interesting things on the India-Pakistan front in the past 5-6 years, they're nowhere near a real breakthrough. But Indian strategic thinkers look on China as their major strategic challenge. They, of course, as I mentioned before, maritime security has become a central security issue rather than an interesting footnote. And, of course, they now are a nuclear weapons-owning state. And they live next door to two of them, China and Pakistan. So that this is a major factor in their overall security outlook. How has this changed the way India and the United States do business? In the past 10 years, and I'm really dating the transformation from 2000 when President Bill Clinton made an epic 5-day trip to India and addressed a joint sitting of Parliament with his legendary political skills on full display and basically had them eating out of his hand. It was quite a remarkable performance for an American president. And he was addressing a group of people who started out fairly skeptical. Since that time, the United States and India, I think, have had remarkable success in building up the bilateral infrastructure for a much more serious relationship. What do I mean by that? I mean the economic relationship between India and the United States, the United States is the most important economic partner for India when you take it all together. We are the largest single foreign investor. We are by far the largest export market. India sees exports and investment as critical elements in its foreign policy. And interestingly, the economic relationship is really mostly private. There's a lot of government-to-government dealings, not all of them totally happy, but what really drives the relationship is that private companies are doing business with one another. And that means that this is going to continue more or less no matter what the governments do in other realms, because people have built up supply chains and investment relationships that they're not going to walk away from. The second area where the bilateral relationship has really been transformed, and I'm sure that Enid Okun will recall this because we first knew each other in a different world on the India-U.S. front, is security. During the years of the Cold War, there basically wasn't a security relationship between the United States and India. There was practically nothing by way of military sales. There was a little bit of token contact between the military in both countries. We attended each other's staff colleges and so on. But nothing serious and nothing that approached strategic dialogue. Now that has changed. You have a very lively program of military exercises. You have a really close relationship between the two navies, which is interesting because in an earlier generation, those were the services that were most suspicious of each other. India has come to see the regular U.S. presence in the Indian Ocean as a good thing rather than something that was vaguely invading their turf. And this has built on, and this is a theme I'm going to come back to, this has built on some important and very practical common interests between India and the United States, which in the changed geopolitical circumstances have kind of bubbled to the surface as important elements in how we do business together. Another area where our bilateral relationship is transformed is education and science. There had always been an interesting and pretty active but small series of scientific exchanges, many of them funded by the government. NIH had big programs in India, for example. But that has really expanded, and what's really expanded is educational exchange. Most of it is towards the United States. At the time I wrote the book, there were 80,000 Indian students in American universities. That's now, only a year later, up to 90,000. And India is by far the country with the largest numbers of students in American institutes of higher learning. The other area that I would single out is high-tech trade and other high-tech contacts. Export controls are a significant impediment to trade in a lot of advanced technologies. That has become not easy, but a lot easier over the past 5-6 years. And then, of course, as you, I'm sure, are aware, the United States and India signed an agreement on civilian nuclear cooperation in the last days of the Bush administration, and the Obama administration has now said publicly that it fully intends to continue that and carry it out. This was an agreement of huge symbolic importance because the nuclear issue, more than anything else, put the U.S. in the position of putting India on the other side of the dividing line between countries with which we have sort of full-fledged scientific relationships and those we don't. There are still some things that need to be done for full implementation to take place, but that basically that way of approaching India has certainly changed. India saw the U.S. as a critical entry point for its economic success and for international acceptance as a serious player. And I think that, on the Indian side, has been an important motivation for this changed relationship. On the other side, we've done really not very much to develop a global relationship, even though we talk about it a lot. We have a very tough time in multilateral forums. India and the U.S. have scratched at each other in the global trade negotiations, and that's probably the best example. And we haven't really consulted much on international issues that go beyond their immediate neighborhood. And in their immediate neighborhood, India expects to have primacy. And so it's fairly selective about how much it wants to deal with the United States. A lot more now than, say, 10 years ago. But this is still a delicate subject. Why does this matter, and where are we going? And my why does it matter question is really, why does it matter to the United States? I think the main reason it matters has to do with the way our overall foreign policy interests have shifted. The center of gravity right after World War II was unambiguously in Europe, with the Western Pacific, Japan, as an important other area. If you take Europe and Asia as the two potential centers of gravity, the needle has moved substantially towards Asia. And they're both important, but Asia certainly has a much greater weight than it used to do. Look what's been happening in Asia. The Japanese are emerging now, but we're in a 10-year slump. China is rising at a rapid rate and is clearly in a position to be the dominant power in Asia, depending on how the other big powers, big Asian powers, play that. India and the United States, one of the things they agree on, although we don't talk about it much, is that neither one wants China to be the only pebble on the Asian beach. There's great uncertainty about what's going to happen in Korea. And then, if you look at sort of the other end of the Asian landmass, India's neighbors to the west are a highly troubled area, not just Pakistan, but even more so Afghanistan. The Persian Gulf, we both have enormous economic interests there and a great interest in stability. What I'm saying is that in this entire area, from the Persian Gulf to the Pacific, India's and U.S. interests are very similar. And because, I mean, no one wants to pick a fight with China, but because no one, at least no one in the serious strategic thinking world in the United States, wants to see China emerge as the unquestioned dominant power in Asia, it becomes very important for the U.S. to have serious security relations and economic relations with the other big players in Asia. That's already true with Japan. It's already true with China. India was the missing piece of this puzzle. And that's now, I think, in the process of being put right. India, moreover, has the largest navy in the Indian Ocean, one of the world's four largest armies, and a middle-class market nearly the size of the U.S. population. These are all things that put a country on the U.S. radar screen. And I think that these interests are going to keep pushing the United States and India together. Does this make us, in the phrases that you occasionally hear from the lips of leaders in both countries, natural allies or strategic partners? I don't like the word allies because I don't see an alliance with its military implications ever happening between the United States and India. They don't want it, and I think neither do we. I mean, certainly the Bush administration was very cool about alliances. The Obama administration is probably a bit more receptive, but I suspect not disposed to multiply the number of countries with whom you have that kind of tight network of obligations. Strategic partners, I would say, not yet, but could and should be getting there. So what are the obstacles to strategic partnership? Well, I would cite two primarily. The first is primarily on the Indian side, and the second is primarily on the U.S. side. On the Indian side, there is a very important piece of their foreign policy that I think the United States has trouble dealing with. The phrase they use is strategic autonomy, and it's what you might call, you know, the last of the offspring of non-alignment. No Indian government can afford to allow people to think that its foreign policy is being made or even excessively influenced by anybody else, and anybody else basically means us. And so when we talk with the Indians about different parts of the world, there is this hesitancy about getting too close to the U.S. position. It's not a showstopper. While the nuclear deal was under negotiation, on two occasions, India voted with the United States and against Iran in the International Atomic Agency. Energy Agency, and they took a lot of domestic flak for it, but they did it. But this leads to a certain hesitancy on India's part, and it also means that the Indian leadership, quite understandably, is going to be looking around in this era of economic crisis to make sure that the U.S. is still capable of being the great power that makes its power both interesting and something to be a little wary of. The other obstacle, which, as I said, is mostly on the U.S. side, has to do with the whole idea of partnership. India hasn't done partnership much. They were non-aligned, and this was a whole different vocabulary. The U.S. has. But most of the countries with which we've had partnerships started out with a very similar view of overall security threats in the world, and many of them started out as military allies. And, of course, they all were a whole lot smaller than the United States. And with a few interesting exceptions like France, generally disposed to accept that situation and to play a mostly sort of kind of following role. That model doesn't work with India. First of all, we're starting out bilaterally and not globally. Secondly, they aren't really interested in institutionalized followership. And so in order to make this partnership work, and I think there's considerable benefit to the United States in doing so, we basically have to reinvent the idea of partnership and how it works. And my formula for that, telescoping a whole lot, is to continue working on the good things that we've started to develop, but to begin quite consciously to take the relationship global. Now, there are four big global issues to which the Obama administration is very committed. One of them is actually a natural area of collaboration, and that it may surprise you. It's financial reform. The reason I say that is that India and China are going to account for much of the growth in the world. The United States has already accepted that they need to have a larger voice in international financial institutions. Who hasn't accepted it are the Europeans, but that's another story. And most of the deliberations about financial reform take place in nice, discreet forums like the G20 and, you know, all these things that start with G, which tend to take place mostly away from the cameras. And that is the best possible setting in which to bring out the inner pragmatists in India's policymakers. So that's a good one to start with. The other three big global issues are going to be a whole lot tougher. Trade, we've already talked about. I actually think that India and the U.S. are still going to have a hard time getting together, and I also think that the U.S. is going to have a very hard time delivering on any international trade agreement for reasons that have nothing to do with India. The other two are nonproliferation and climate change. Climate change, we have on paper disagreed with India for years. The issue has been how much obligation should developing countries, read India, have to take in capping emissions. But until the Obama administration came into office, this didn't matter because the U.S. basically wasn't interested in moving ahead anyway. Now we are, and it does matter. And this is going to be a difficult one. We're going to have to find other ways to measure progress besides simply capping emissions. I mean, there are other pieces of that puzzle. That one will remain, but there will be others as well. Nonproliferation is an interesting situation because I think we have a real opportunity to reshape the nonproliferation system so that it can bring countries like India, which have not signed the nonproliferation treaty and will never be able to sign the nonproliferation treaty, into at least some parts of the tent so that they become active participants in the effort to make sure that nuclear technology doesn't get into the hands of the most deeply irresponsible players in the world. This is going to require some new thinking, and I think the administration, frankly, hasn't given it much thought yet, but I'm hopeful that at some point they will be willing to try to operate on a larger canvas in the nonproliferation world. The one thing I saved for last is probably one of the first things that came to your minds, and that is two big democracies. This has always been at the philosophical level one of the things that brought India and the United States together. At the practical level, it was a complication as often as it was a bond. Why? Because our political audiences expect quite different things and sometimes kind of opposite things. While the nuclear deal was being negotiated, this came out on both sides of the ocean. The United States had to pass legislation twice in order to implement the nuclear deal. In pushing the legislation through the Congress, and this started out at a time when there was a Republican administration and a Republican Congress, so the Indians assumed, based on their system, the administration writes the legislation, the Congress passes it, what's the problem? The problem, of course, is that that's not the way it works in our country. And so we went through the usual bobbing and weaving and taking binding clauses and turning them into report requirements and all the standard things that are the way you kind of grease legislation through the U.S. legislative process. And on the American side, we figured, we got it through. Good job. On the Indian side, they were saying, wait a minute, you're going to have to give us a report card every bleeping year? Where do you get off? Then India, under pressure from one of its coalition partners, the Indian government, put the whole deal on in the deep freeze for a year because they were afraid that the communist parties would pull out of the government and bring the government down. Shock, not awe, on the U.S. side. How can this happen? Well, in their system, if you lose the wrong vote in Parliament, you're gone, you're history, you're toast. Eventually, both sides got it through, but it was an interesting lesson in how the democratic systems sometimes don't mesh terribly well. However, I will end on the good side of the democracy story, and that is that when you have both democracy as a philosophical bond and as something that you share in your regular political life, and more concrete interests in common, you have the potential of reaching a kind of foreign policy sweet spot. I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think we have the potential of getting there, and it's been an exciting process to watch so far, and I'm hoping that this is one of the things that is going to help shape the globe in a constructive way in the next couple of decades. So thank you very much. And I'd be delighted to take questions. Yes, sir.
You said India, you either said they can't or they won't sign non-proliferation treaties. Why not?
They have nuclear weapons. They made their nuclear explosion after the cutoff date for signing as a nuclear weapons state. They're not going to give up their nuclear weapons. The NPT is not theoretically, but practically unamendable. Therefore, there's no way of squaring that circle. Back of the room, sir. The question was, what are the cracks in India's relationship with China and how dangerous are they? I think India's relationship with China is kind of schizophrenic. On the one hand, there's a very active economic relationship, and there's been much improved political atmospherics. China is taking India more seriously than it used to. On the other hand, China's military buildup is of great concern to India's military and their strategic thinkers. They are in particular concerned about China's growing military relationship with different countries around the Indian Ocean. The phrase that's used is the string of pearls. There's an island off Burma where the Chinese are supposed to be building some kind of facility. The Chinese are funding a port in Pakistan, just on the Pakistani side of the border with Iran. The Chinese are said to be building a port in southern Sri Lanka. The area that they've picked is a crummy place for a port because it's a very sandy, silty coast, but it's nonetheless kind of the three points of the triangle that surrounds India in the Indian Ocean. And I think that's something that has the Indians worried. The other thing is that India has, I think, perhaps miscalculated the kind of political game that China was playing. While the nuclear deal was under consideration, they thought they had an understanding with China that it wouldn't try to prevent the nuclear suppliers group from approving civilian nuclear trade with India. And the Chinese did try to prevent it. The Chinese ultimately didn't prevent it because they didn't want to be the bad guys. But there are multiple opportunities for China to sort of make nice and then try to undercut something India was trying to do. There have also been periodic statements from China raising their border issues and in particular claiming sovereignty over one of the relatively few parts of their disputed border that actually has a lot of people living in it, which is it's the state of Arunachal Pradesh in northeastern India. And the Indians see this as a hostile act. They don't see this as the precursor to a war, but they see this as an effort to keep them off base. The Chinese helped the Pakistanis build their nuclear bomb and still have a close relationship with Pakistan. So these are the things that worry the Indians. I would say they're not dangerous in the short term because neither India nor China wants to interrupt its march to prosperity to have themselves a war. But it's something that's going to keep tugging the region in different directions. Yes, sir.
Since the U.S. is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, India cannot be. What exactly, first of all, is it a little bit hypocritical since the Non-Proliferation Treaty is the law of the land, the Supreme Law of the land? And what does the Non-Proliferation Treaty accomplish for us? The hypocrisy has to do with our relationship to Iran, which is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and is under the treaty entitled to enrich uranium. What is the benefit that we have achieved through the nuclear supply?
The question is, aren't we being hypocritical about the Non-Proliferation Treaty, especially in light of the fact that Iran is a signatory and India is not? And what benefit do we get from the nuclear deal? There are a number of anomalies in the way the Non-Proliferation Treaty works. North Korea signed. North Korea pulled out. There is a dispute over whether that withdrawal was actually effective or not. North Korea then exploded a nuclear device. Iran signed both the Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency had called on Iran to stop moving towards enrichment. I think a lot of countries, certainly including the United States, and interestingly enough, even including India, have taken the position that if you sign an agreement and if you sign up to various organizations like the IAEA, that carries with it an obligation to, you know, do what the institution asks of you when it does so in a sufficiently solemn way. I don't think that's why the Bush administration took such a strong position on Iran's nuclear program, nor why the Obama administration has continued that. I think they were basically driven by an absolute conviction that weapons was what the Iranians were after, and that the Iranians were not likely to act responsibly, particularly not under the present management. And so I think, that's why the United States has been pushing so hard on this issue, and the new administration has continued to do so. I guess I don't see this as hypocritical, because I don't see anything in the obligations of the NPT that oblige you to accept anything that another country thinks they can shoehorn in under their entitlement as a signatory, especially when they're not prepared to slow down the march to reassure the rest of the international community. What do we get out of the civilian nuclear treaty agreement with India? The main benefits are in terms of the relationship with India. And different people have different views on that. I think that the main problems that we face in the nonproliferation realm have to do not with countries like India that are in the main acting responsibly and trying to keep their own assets under control, but have to do with those who are spreading the technology and who have shown over the years that they're prepared to tell the world to take a flying leap when it suits them. So I worry a lot more about transfer. For that reason, I worry more about Pakistan than about India. They have a track record there. There is an argument that the other benefit of the civilian nuclear agreement with India ought to be that India would come more fully into the nonproliferation world. I would like to see that happen. It has not happened yet. I think it will take a lot of very clever and far-seeing diplomacy on a lot of people's parts to make it happen. Yes?
How important is it for those of us who want to know more about India and to understand, to know about the Hindu religion and its impact on their culture?
I think it's important to understand something, but the reason that I kind of sighed is that I'm not sure whether it's more accurate to describe this as a philosophy, a collection of philosophies, a social system, or a religion, because they're elements of all of those things. When I first got married, my husband had lived for 6 years in India and was already an established India hand. And I would ask him, you know, these questions about what do Hindus believe and so on. And he sort of laughed. You know, nice Catholic girl who's grown up learning the Baltimore Catechism by heart. You know, for most parts of Christianity, you can answer that question. For Judaism, you can answer that question. For Islam, you can answer that question. For Hinduism, you really cannot. You know, there are deities that have a following, and you're kind of born into that. There is a social organization. It's the caste system, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody follows all of the traditions of it. I think one of the important things to understand is that Hinduism, insofar as it is an ism, is socially exclusive and theologically or creedally inclusive. And so the nice, neat categories into which we are often accustomed to putting ideas and concepts and beliefs kind of all get smushed up. I remember going out to visit the quarters of my nanny whose daughter was getting engaged, and I was paying a courtesy call. And she had this shelf with pictures of various holy people. And they were all there. You mean you had Radha and Krishna and Ram and Sita and the Blessed Virgin and the Holy Family, and they were all there. It was anybody who might be important you would want to be sure and propitiate. Now, she was pretty far down the social scale, so the idea of having to propitiate important people was something that came real naturally to her. One more, the gentleman in the back of the room. That is a very good question and a kind of complicated one. The question is, with the U.S. heavy involvement in in Pakistan and Afghanistan, what role is India playing in this? Helpful, unhelpful? How do they feel about it? The last part is the easiest to answer. I think that India is always a little bit uneasy when the United States gets into bed with Pakistan, but net-net they are relieved that we are still actively involved in Afghanistan. There is a strong policy consensus in India at this time that they are better off if Pakistan remains reasonably stable. That, by the way, is the principal reason that there wasn't any military response after the attacks on Bombay last November. India would like to play a bigger role in Afghanistan. They are, at the moment, one of the significant donors to economic reconstruction. They've been doing a lot of road building. There is a long traditional relationship between India and Afghanistan. There are a lot of, you know, children of the relatively well-off who go to India to study. Those people tend to not to be quite as well-off as those who send their kids to the United States to study. India would like to do a lot more of that, would like to build up their relationship with Afghanistan. This drives the Pakistanis nuts. The Pakistanis have 60 years' worth of very difficult relations with Afghanistan for reasons that are both geopolitical and ethnic. They look with enormous suspicion on anything India might do there. They see themselves as caught in a giant pincer movement between India in India and India in Afghanistan. Their fears are not frivolous, but I think they're quite exaggerated. But partly as a result of Pakistan's sensitivities, and because we are still very dependent on Pakistan for the Afghan effort, especially for logistical support, the U.S. has not pushed back too much on that. We have welcomed India's economic role. We have not encouraged them to have a security role. I know that Dick Holbrooke is trying to expand that a bit and trying to set up some kind of a Friends of Afghanistan group. I'm guessing it probably won't happen that way because I think the Pakistanis will freak out. But the fact that this is a serious subject of discussion between the United States and India is evidence of how much things have changed. Well, I think that's my curtain call. I'm following the boss.
You've been listening to retired U.S. Ambassador Teresita Schaefer on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, it will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.